The following is Hans Kruger, Jared Spool, Chris Baum, Andy Budd, and Amy Cuevas' panel discussion, The New Black, Running a Small Agency, from the 2014 Information Architecture Summit. The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. Stay tuned after the podcast for more information about All You Can Learn.
All right, so thanks everyone for coming. This is The New Black, Running a Small Agency. Agency is somewhat of a flexible question here. It could be a studio, it could be a consultancy. Call it what you will, but it's running your own business. And more than just you is the criteria. Before we get started, so that we can sort of set some context on who is out there and what you're interested in, can you raise your hand if you're a freelancer? Okay, consultant. Not that I know really the difference, but we can discuss that later. Who's a full-time employee? All right. Who run agencies now? Or consultancies, et cetera, et cetera. Lovely. Who are thinking about it? Interesting. Okay. And if not, why are you here? I'm kidding. Please stay.
Who hates raising their hands in little surveys? Okay. That's our margin of error.
That's right. Good job. Okay. So what we're going to do first, I guess I should introduce myself. Hi, I'm Chris Baum. I'm one of the founding partners of Future Draft in Oakland, California. We are a small agency, and for those who are considering running agencies themselves, I was you, sort of accidentally, a couple years ago. And it was about that time that I met my two business partners and am now a very happy agency runner person. But I'm going to start with Jared. This is Jared Spool, Amy Cueva, Andy Budd, and Hans Kruger. They are our fancy panel guests. I'd like each one of them to take 2 minutes to talk about themselves and discuss some of the lessons they've learned as someone who runs an organization, because yes, Jared, you also run an organization.
I run two right now. So I have two companies now. I have User Interface Engineering and I have Center. User Interface Engineering started as a consulting agency years ago and has morphed into something not a consulting agency for the most part, but about 15% of our revenue comes from consulting work. The rest of it is services like our conferences and training and our new All You Can Learn service, which you should sign up for. Center is a school, but it has a real sort of consulting piece to it because the students all work on projects that come from outside sources with real clients. So we have this interesting challenge of trying to figure out how to blend that in an educational format. So the biggest challenges always come from hiring the right people. That's where you start. That's the most difficult thing. So that's where I would put the biggest challenge to be.
And talk a little bit about your background.
Where did you come currently from? Mauve. My background, so I started as a software engineer back in the 70s and was doing user experience usability work then before anybody called it user experience usability work, and had a series of jobs in real companies that all ended in some sort of termination. And the last time I was fired for what was officially a dress code violation, I started user interface engineering with the intent of doing that until I found another real job, and I haven't found it yet. That was in 1988, so user interface engineering will be 26 years old this year. We were 25 last year, which means we could rent a car.
Congratulations.
Thank you. You should have seen when we were 18. We partied.
Yes, you did. So, Amy, please.
Hi, I'm Amy, one of the founders at MadPow and Chief Experience Officer. That's the good thing about starting up on your own. You can pick your own title. And we started MadPow about 10 years ago, sort of by accident. My business partner and myself had worked at a design firm together. Dot-com bubble burst, agency went pew, and we were freelancing, teamed up on a project, it went really well. We said, let's do another. Let's hire somebody. I think we have something here. And now we've grown to about 60 people across 3 offices, and I would agree that it's all about the people, hiring great people. And you gotta be a little crazy to run an agency. No offense, guys, I hope you'll agree. Because it's
I think you have to be really crazy.
Really crazy, yeah, because it's hard work, and you've got to take risks, and you've got to follow your gut, and you've got to back up that gut and intuition with due diligence and finding the best people you can possibly find on your team. An entrepreneur yesterday actually said something really interesting to me, and that was, you have to be ready to experience the highest highs in your life and the lowest lows, and be ready to experience them in the same hour. And I can definitely attest that that is something that happens all the time.
Okay.
Mr. Budd.
Hi, everyone. So my name's Andy Budd. I am one of the co-founders of a UX agency in the UK called Clear Left. We were one of the first agencies in the UK to kind of adopt sort of the UX title, though obviously there have been plenty of people doing usability and IA before us. We're about 10 years old now, so yeah, we're still in our sort of terrible kind of, you know, toddler stages. From the start, we wanted to stay small, and I guess one of the questions that we're going to discuss is what small means, because to me, 60 people doesn't feel like a small agency. In fact, to me, 20 people, which is where we are at the moment, is starting to not feel like a small agency as well. I guess we started deliberately as a lifestyle business, and I think for a lot of people, and particularly a lot of people in the US, the idea of starting a business not to make huge amounts of cash might seem like a little bit strange, but we saw a lot of these bigger agencies growing up, being focused on the money and not on the work, being focused on growing really, really quickly in spite of quality rather than because of quality, and we didn't want to be that person. We wanted to be a company that was focused purely around doing great design work with maybe a naive idea that if we did good work, the money would come in. Fortunately, it sort of has, but you know, unlike a lot of agencies that seem to be dominated by utilization rates and how much they're billing, we're dominated by giving our clients a really, really good service, and consequently, I don't make an awful lot of money, but you know, such is life. So yeah, I guess that's my background.
Lovely. Hans.
Thank you, Chris. I'm actually working with Chris. I'm also one of the founders of FutureDraft, and you know, a couple of years ago we started it, and it's been really, really interesting. Before that, I should say that I'm actually not a designer. I'm not a UX designer. I am by profession a manager, an MBA. And I started, I was one of the founders of Meta Design in Berlin in 1989, I guess, with Eric Spiekermann and Uli Meyer. And I was the CEO of that company for 12 years, and I can tell you that was quite a ride. And if I would summarize, I mean, this was an interesting period, of course. It brought all these technical, radical innovations that we're seeing coming more and more to fruition now. So one of the things about Meta Design was it was always able to, even though, you know, a corporate identity, corporate design, high-end design firm, we were able to embrace technology and really go with all these things as they came up. And I would say one of the things I've observed over, yeah, I have to say decades now, is that in a business there are really three distinct competencies that need to be represented when you start a company. And one of them is, of course, the design skill. You need to be really good at what you're doing. It's your core product, right? It's what you're selling. You need to be good at it. Then there's the whole business paradigm. You need to run the business in a smart way. So you need to make sure that designers are not in any way obstructed by the business side of it. You have to establish like this sort of common denominator that makes actually this thing work together. But then there's a third side, and that is what I call the human side of the business. And that is the side where you're basically managing the whole partner process, where the emotional landscape in the company, where you're working with that, where you're shaping that. And guess what? Anybody wants to take a guess where companies fail most of the time? In which area? Business, design, or the personal process? You probably know the answer, right? So in order for something to work, my time is probably up, you have to have competency in all these three areas.
Lovely, thank
Chris,
you.
Chris, I liked what Andy said. Can I actually speak to that for a second?
Sure.
Okay, because it's a good reminder. So when you're small, you can kind of talk to everybody and there's this vibe and everybody knows what we're all in it for and stuff. And as we scaled, we found that we needed to actually document our core values. We're like, oh no, what's happening? But those core values were quality first, then customer satisfaction, then profits. And the reason why they were in that rank was because clients will ask you to do crazy things, sacrifice quality, so they can't be on top. And if they ask you to do crazy things and you don't deliver quality, they're not gonna come back for more, and your portfolio is gonna suffer and your reputation as a result. So quality first and foremost, always number one. And then client satisfaction, and then profit. So client satisfaction over profit, because if you're satisfying clients, they're coming back for more. But profit, definitely on the list. I could figure out, you know, 16 ways to bankrupt my company in the next hour. Oh, you want to go to 16 conferences? Go ahead. Oh, you want free work? Yes, all day long. But you're not going to stay in business very long if you're not paying attention to those sorts of things. So we will do free work, and we do believe in EDU and everything else, but we have to kind of abide by and be aware of the natural tension between all of those sort of components.
Very good. So I think these are super interesting questions, but I think we need to start out for someone who's considering, you know, running an agency, what do you not know when you start out? What do you wish you knew when you started out that you didn't know? So that someone considering this needs to be aware of these things.
I'm happy to jump in. I think there's a perception that if you're a freelancer, you're looking at the amount of money that's coming in and you think, oh, this is great. If I hire more people, then I'll make more money and it's going to be an easy route to profit. The interesting thing is obviously when ClearLeft started, we were the most profitable. We made the most money when it was just the two founders working together in their respective bedrooms with almost no overheads. And as soon as you start adding people, your profitability goes down and down and down until effectively, and this is maybe the bad business decisions I'm, you know, using to run the company and focusing on culture above profits, but we probably are the least best paid remunerated people in the organization. Because our focus is, you know, we've grown a family, and if you're a parent, you know, you start giving all of your needs to those children. You focus on their comfort, their desire, their profitability, their sense of self-worth, and you end up having to kind of give all of this away. And so you tend to find that what you end up growing is you end up growing this fluffy concept of value, i.e. you're building something bigger, you're building something that's greater than the individuals involved. But in terms of it being a great financial idea, I'd say, you know, that's wrong. Stick with being a freelancer. So I think if you want to grow a business, you have to have an understanding about why you're doing it. You know, if you want a nice lifestyle, then like I say, freelancing is really good. If you want to build value in the web, if you want to help more people solve more problems, more meaningful problems and bigger problems, I think that's a really, really good reason to get involved in this space. So yeah, that's my sort of starting perspective, I guess.
Yeah, and if I may chime in, I think if I look back now on this insane period in the 90s, and I look back on it from today's perspective, I would say what I was lacking was more psychological knowledge. The question is, what is your ambition, really, when you start a business, right? What is your ambition? You talked about the difference between a freelancer and a small business, but what is your ambition? Do you want to have like a shop that, you know, is good for like three people and you do like local work? And what is the ambition, right? Is the ambition to go out there and change the world, do a groundbreaking work, build something that has a real value as a company, right? So is that the ambition? Then you need to look at it a little bit differently, right? So because actually what happens later on is pretty much determined at the beginning. How you start out, that gets you on a certain trajectory. So you have to think about that carefully. And like I said in the beginning, these three areas, you know, if you, for example, weak in the business side, you can be really, really successful. You can do great design work, but there's like a hump that you can never get over. The question is, how long can you endure that? You know, and the next question is, are you making the sort of money that actually allows this to, and the business side, I should clarify that, is not about making money. It's much more than that. It's the whole administrative side of the business. And does it overwhelm? Is it handled elegantly? Is the overhead low? Is all of that, you know? And anyway, looking back from today, what I was lacking in the time with Meta Design is the psychological knowledge. Holy cow. I mean, like just the balancing of the partner interests. And like I said in the beginning, look where companies fail.
I mean, yeah, just to add to that, I mean, yeah, being a great designer doesn't mean you're going to be a good manager. It doesn't mean you're going to be great with clients. And I think the other thing is thinking about your own self and where you want to be. I think a lot of designers get into it because they want to do more design. And the reality is if you're running a business, you're going to do less design. That's going to tail off quite quickly. And a lot of senior people really, really struggle quite late into their career just to maintain that little 10% or 20% of client work, but it's tough. So one of my colleagues, Jeremy Keith, talks about this in terms of startups. startups. He says, you know, don't worry about what will happen if you fail. Think about what will happen if you succeed. And I think that's the approach. Like, if you're successful, if you're running the most successful agency you can imagine, what is that going to mean for your life, your day-to-day relationships, and is that going to make you feel happy? And if that is the case, if you can imagine yourself being a professional manager of a team of 20 very, very needy individuals, and you love giving and you're that kind of giving person, and that's great. If you want to be, you know, hands in the design, then it's probably not the right position for you.
Thank you. Jared, I would actually like to hear your thoughts on these issues.
I'm just taking notes. I think there's three things that it took me more than a decade to realize how important it was. The first one is staffing. The most important job any company owner has is to figure out who they're going to work with and what they need that person to do. And it's really tempting to hire people because you really like them. They're somebody you hang out with, maybe you even worked together on a project before, and you really like hanging out with them. And to sort of gloss over the rest of a hiring process. And what ends up happening is you end up bringing on people who you really like who inevitably don't fit the needs of the business. And the first few hires I had, I was extremely lucky. And everybody who I liked just happened to work out really great. So I thought I had this thing nailed. And then I had, in a row, three or four hires who were great people who turned out to be real disasters for the business as we were growing. And it became a huge morale suck. There was a guy in Rotterdam who did a study. He studied team dynamics, and he would have people do projects together, these teams of subjects from in the study, except that one of the people was an actor. And sometimes the actor would know how to do the project really well, sometimes the actor would just be a sort of a neutral player, and sometimes the actor would actually be really disruptive to the team and like put his feet up on the table and read the paper while they're trying to work, or actually give them the wrong answers at time and things like that, and being very belligerent about it. And it turned out that the study showed that a team's ability to succeed is not based on the best person on the team. It's not based on the average of all the people on the team. It's based on the worst person on the team. So your worst person is going to determine how good you are. And worst doesn't necessarily mean that they're nasty, ugly people. It means that they are not suited for the job that you're doing. So staffing is probably the first thing. The second thing that I think was a real lesson for me was there's been lots of talk about profit. Profit is not important at all. Cash flow is important. Understanding where the money is. The number one key performance indicator for any agency is number of weeks of payroll in the bank. If you don't know how many weeks of payroll you have right now, you're screwed. And that number at any given time is the sole focus of the business side for any really competent agency, because it's all about figuring out how each project pays and when that money comes in. Then the third thing is we spent 10 years doing what I would call anything for a buck consulting, which is basically, hey, there's a cool project, it'll pay a lot of money, let's do that. And we would just keep doing that. And over time, what we realized was that we were not very good at anything we did. And that the agencies that I saw were best learn what to say no to very fast. They could take really great projects, but they say no to them because they're not the projects that they want to work on to make their mark in the world. Understanding exactly how you're going to say no and when you're going to say no to it. And here's the thing about real values. Values only matter when it's actually uncomfortable to follow them, right? When it's easy to follow them, values are not that interesting. But when you have to make the hard choice because that's where your values are, that's really the key thing. And so in starting the new business, these were things that we focused on right from the start. The way we're hiring, the way we're managing cash, and exactly what we're not doing, and keeping that list really big.
Could I address a couple of those points, if we've got time? Or do you want to move on to...
Yeah, 1 minute.
Oh, sorry. So you meant 1 minute. Okay. In terms of cash flow, one of the things ClearLeft did when we first started was guarantee that we'd have a minimum of 3 months' worth of cash in the bank, up to ideally 6 months. And that sounds like a lot, but actually what that did is it meant that we were a little bit more fearless when we could say no to projects, because we knew that we weren't sort of chasing the next project. And I've met so many company founders that when I talk to them, their biggest number one cause of stress is the fact that they're always 3-4 weeks away from going bankrupt. And if you spend 10 years on the verge of bankruptcy, that's not a really nice place to be. And then you start making really, really bad decisions, you know, basically because you've got a lot of people to feed. I think that also feeds into the staying small element. Like, if you are on this massive growth path, then you have to grow faster than your cash flow can support. And you also have to take on work that is below you. We've been in a really good position where we've actually, because we've always grown really, really small, we're allowed to turn work away. If you're on this massive growth path, then you can't do that. And then what happens is not only do you have really low cash flow, but then you're doing work that your staff don't enjoy, which adds to the third point, which is hiring good people. We hire for culture. We only hire seniors. And those two things have set us off really, really well. It does have its own problems, which we'll probably get onto in a little bit. But having senior people that know what they're doing means that there's really very little kind of managerial overhead you need to look after on a day-to-day basis. You're serving their emotional needs rather than their practical needs. It also means that you've got to be really careful about the work they do, because you know that if you're bringing in mediocre work, they're going to go. We've never, ever hired because a job came in and we needed to fill that position. We'd turn work down, and usually, I mean, you know, it's really frustrating, but our hiring process is usually 2 to 3 months per person, from them applying for the job to them getting the job. And that's because, you know, we're just really careful about hiring cultural fit. And we're really fortunate, it might just be luck, but we've never had to let anyone go. And I'd hate to be in a position where we'd had to do that, because I'm not very good at those kind of confrontations. So I'm fortunate that's never been an issue.
So we're talking a lot about hiring, and I think that's good. But imagine from the beginning of the business. I mean, all of you have been at some point in the beginning of the business where it was super small, maybe you and maybe one other person. How do you decide when it's time to hire, or that the demand that you have is just a blip? How do you know that it's time? What does that mean?
Yeah, one thing it actually ties to the previous point is we actually did something right in the beginning, which is awesome when that happens. And it's a tip, is to understand your blind spots. My business partner, myself, we were designers. So managing cash flow was not something that we knew how to do. There were no accounting courses in art school. So one of our early hires was a COO with an MBA, because guys like you keep us in business. And, you know, doing things like paying your taxes. You didn't make 10 grand, you made 7. Government gets the other 3K. So, you know, just shifting that mentality, and, you know, he helped set us up with credit lines and set us up with employee benefits, and just be, you know, we're like really goal oriented. We want to do this, we want to do that. Backing that up with us, stability and things, and getting that other perspective was really valuable. And so we're glad we did that early. But you make a good point, because when you're running an agency, it's a constant seesaw of too much work, not enough people, or too many people, not enough work. To your point, if you stay a consistent size, then you can be selective and not let any work into that bubble that would kind of disrupt that equilibrium on the seesaw. How we've managed it is to have a pool of excellent consultants that we can use on an as-needed basis if there is a really juicy, wonderful, life-changing, make the world a better place project that we really want to take on and we need a little extra help. We'll look to that pool of consultants to help us expand bandwidth a little bit during that time period. If it turns out we're working with them for 3 and 4 years, then it's probably time to hire somebody full time and then kind of continue. One thing kind of tied to that, it's not associated with hiring, but it's associated with career pathing, and that is our employees are really passionate. They have their own passions, they have their own desires, and we try to understand what that is, listen to it, and go with them along that path. So your path at MadPow is sort of choose your own adventure. You're passionate about health? Let's do it. You know, become a thought leader. What do you want to be working on? How do we get business like that? Because when they have skin in the game and when they're passionate about it, we're going to do amazing things. So we've actually formed a training discipline. We've formed a behavior change discipline. We have a health practice. And those are all centered around the passions of the employees that we have. So they kind of, it wasn't hiring, it was kind of repositioning themselves within the culture of the company.
So. I would add, I mean, at the beginning, when you start, take the time to go through a process. You probably invent it, you should invent it, because it has to fit you as a person. But go through a process where whatever you do, take the time to really talk about what are you really good at? Where are your weak spots? You know, what kind of model is the right model for you? Do you want to become like, you start something and the eventual goal is you want to become like a subsidiary of a European company? What do you want to build? Talk about how all these possibilities that you have and map them against your strengths, because you'll find out what is really the right path that way. We did this at FutureDrive. We took a lot of time. We took a few months to do that. And then I think the important thing is to play, meaning you're in the game. Don't let dogma take you over. One of the things we did, I think, fairly well at Meta was we very clearly said at the beginning, we're never going to grow beyond 20. You know, that's it, right? Anybody who knows this story knows that was blown out of the water pretty quickly, exactly after 6 months, you know, and it went to hundreds of people and an international company. But it's because we were playing, we were participating in the game, we were answering our call, right? If you don't do that, you're sort of refusing to participate in this game that goes on, in this dance out there, this dance of, you know, people trying to find you, businesses trying to find you. It's sort of a dance, really, you know, and you want to play. So don't let dogma stop you from playing. That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's actually a great segue to marketing and actually bringing in business. Andy, why don't you talk a little bit about how you all drive your business development process and how that's evolved over time?
We don't have a business development process. People email us, they say, you know, here's a proposal, do you want to work on it? We look at it, that's it. I mean, there's no active solicitation, we don't advertise, we don't cold call, we don't respond to speculative briefs. You know, we sit there and people pick up the phone and then we engage. I guess part of that is because the three initial founders had a certain amount of notoriety. I think part of that is because we like going and talking at places like this, and I guess people hear that we're good at what we do. My job, really, the business development job that I have is really weird. It's the opposite of what most business developers do, because most business development is go out and win work, and if you win work, you'll get a bonus. My job is to go out and put people off of using ClearLeft. And it's a really weird idea, but basically...
But you're really good at it.
I am. I'm an expert. Thank you very much. I learned everything from you. no, but basically, I see it like dating. You know, don't just jump into bed with the first prospect that comes along, because actually there's a really good chance they're not going to be the right fit. In the same way as making sure you've got cultural fit with your staff, you need to make sure you've got cultural fit with your clients. And the biggest mistake I see is agencies being so needy and so desperate that they engage with the wrong kinds of clients. And if you're engaging with the wrong kind of client, you're not able to do your best work. So we'll have maybe three or four proposals out at any one stage, of which we can only have one, because we're small, and that's given us a huge benefit. And so my job is to go around and talk to the clients. Because I'm not in this level of fear that I'm afraid that I must impress them, they must like me, because if they don't like me, my business is going to go bankrupt. I'm actually in a position of confidence and in a position of power, because I get to decide, to a certain extent, you know, if out of these four or five agencies or clients, three of them want to work with me, I get to decide who we bestow our gift of design onto. And that sounds really egotistical, but there's this weird idea that money is really, really valuable and in short supply. That, like, we've got this thing of design which anyone can do, and there's this precious thing called money. And in reality, it's the other way around. The things that we can do in this room are unique, and they're special, and they're needed by people. Money's all over the place. There's millions and millions and millions of companies out there with loads of money, often going to really, really shitty design agencies. You guys have something special. So understand that, understand your value, and don't sell yourself cheaply to the first suitor that comes along. And I think that would be my biggest kind of piece of advice for new business development.
Well, anyone
yeah, it can.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Tying together some of your thoughts between the two of you, what you're talking about is transformative. We've approached growth in a different way. We feel like it's our responsibility to grow because we have a good head on our shoulders. We believe that design can make the world a better place, and it is this precious thing that we can bestow on others. We believe in the quality of our team, in the quality of our work, in our mission to improve the human condition through design. We believe in that to our core, and we're a good place to work. So why not provide more opportunities for more people to work at a kick-ass agency and maybe leave the one they're not liking so much, the sucky ones like you mentioned? So we feel it's our responsibility to grow and to continue to do amazing things if, to your point, you can be selective, and cash flow is so important because you're living in fear. You can't be selective around what kinds of clients you're going to go after. And the cultural fit, to your point, is so important as well, because you can't create amazing things with clients who are not also wanting to create amazing things. And that is demoralizing for the team. And the whole transformative thing is to be selective. It took us a while. We figured some mad pal is better than no mad pal. So we're going to help you out a little bit, and you'll be better off for it, and we'll feel good about that. But then we discovered that that little bit we were helping wasn't enough for us, and it wasn't enough for them. And then we said, you know, if something isn't measured and if you're not feeling pressure around it, then you're not going to follow it. So we've come up with a list of criteria that we're kind of measuring clients against now. And now it's not, hey, dance vendor, dance, impress me. It's more like, dance prospect, dance, impress me. And do they fit these criteria? And it's hard because, you know, I'll forget and I'll say, oh, let's do this. And my coworker will say, does it meet the four things that we discussed? And I'm like, no. Then tell them no. Okay. And so we're having to do this with each other. So it's been interesting.
Awesome.
Thank you. I would like to add something about getting new projects. That's one of the important lessons. One of the distinctions I have always made is there are companies who delegate this sort of task to salespeople, and there are companies who don't, right? Design firms. I'm clearly on that other side. Never, ever delegate sales to a salesperson. So it's you want every designer in your team to be selling, you know, to be out there, develop relationship with the client where the next project comes from organically. That's an important point.
Awesome. Thanks. Okay, so right now in this moment in history, you know, design is in huge demand. Obviously, there are certain situations where there's a lot of pressure on agencies to grow because there's a lot of business out there. I would love to hear your thoughts on the dangers of that situation. Because there's so much demand on the design agencies at this point, it seems like it would be easy to start one now. What are the things you have to be aware of when it's not so robust? Jared, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, you have to design for the worst times, I think, when you're thinking of your agency. You have to think about what is your process going to be when you have too many mouths to feed and not enough cash coming in. And this is just a reality that everybody but Andy has to deal with. And it's difficult because you don't know when budget strings are going to tighten because planes have flown into buildings. We have gone through three recessions since I started user interface engineering. And in each one of them, the cash spigot just basically came to a halt. And projects were put on hold. Sales processes went from, you know, a few weeks to close to 6 months to close. The people you would deal with at the client were suddenly gone. We were doing a project. It was a one-week user research usability testing project. And on day three, we had to interrupt our usability test for an all-hands meeting to find out that the team was being laid off. Wow. So that project we actually finished and got paid for. That shocked the hell out of me. We only had 2.5 more days left. You have to understand what your business is going to be like in that modality. And when you can understand that, you can then build on top of it for the better times, for the easier times, for the things that are there. So strategies like using outside part-time help, like Amy does, becomes a strategy, or saying no to projects that are beyond your capacity becomes a strategy, and making sure that you have the savings in the bank to get you through the hard times, and knowing lots of tricks for collecting money faster than clients want to give it to you is another. And so all of these things become sort of key to that. The other thing is to know what you do with your time when you're not consulting, and to also know that you have to have time when you're not consulting. If you're going to have your designers out be selling, that's time they're not billing. And so understanding how you manage utilization hours, which is the Higgs boson particle of consulting practices, how you manage the utilization hours within your organization so that you know how much time do you need to be actually doing billable work versus how much time do you spend doing these non-billable work that build your reputation, that has you outselling, that helps you close deals, that, you know, has you speak at conferences and giving workshops, whatever those things are that you're doing to make that work.
We have like a minute-ish. So like what I love to do, starting with Hans, go through and give one last statement of something you haven't had a chance to say that is in your mind that you would like to say. So Hans.
I would say it really is worth it to make that step. It's daunting at times, yes, but it's definitely worth it. I did not regret it one moment. And, you know, after not starting a company for 8 years, I did it again because finally I said, you know, this is really it, what I have to do. It's so much fun to build something.
Just to touch on something Jared said, I think one of the ways to kind of avoid getting into some of these financial troubles is to diversify. So many of the agencies I've seen that have struggled and gone through boom and bust is because they put all of their attention on a very small number of sectors. Like, we are going to own healthcare and we are going to own local government or universities or what have you. And that's great. And suddenly you've got this really simple pump of every time you do one job in that sector, you do a really good job, three come in and three come in. But then all of a sudden is you hit a financial situation and suddenly all of that work dries up. And I've seen agency time and time and time and again put their eggs in one basket only to kind of fail and implode when a particular sector struggles. So one of the things that we've always done is to bounce around. You know, we're really, really conscious. We don't want to work in any one sector for more than about 12, 18 months. Partly because we want to take the great design learnings we've taken from one sector and apply it to a new client. Because frankly, I think once you've done your 15th university site or even your fifth, it's kind of boring and you're not solving any design challenges. You get really good at solving the same problem, but it's not exciting for our team. But by having that diversity that allows you to move around and respond to kind of dramatic changes in sort of the marketplace, I guess.
Great, thanks. Amy?
I have a bunch. So know your blind spots, know what you're bad at, and get help with that. Ask for help. Learn how to delegate. You're going to do things the best, better than anybody else, but you can't do everything and also lead and manage a team. So as you grow, delegation is so hard and so important. The other thing is, you're awesome. Be awesome. Relish in that awesomeness. I think one thing that I would say I regret is I can't believe it's 2014. Like, are you serious? It's not 2004 right now. Where did the past 10 years go? I'm always like, what's next? What's next? What's next? You know, we did that. That's nice. Whatever. What's next? And forgot to kind of check out the scenery along the way and kind of enjoy the whole thing while it's happening. And part of that is maintaining awareness around not getting sucked into the vortex that is work as an entrepreneur. You could spend 80 hours at the office, but is that what you want your life to be like? So constantly asking yourself, what am I doing that I shouldn't be doing? And what should I be doing that I'm not doing? And ultimately, what do I want to do? And if, to your point, you form this personal vision and charter for yourself and for your company, that will sort of be your guiding beacon as you move forward and you can continue to adjust along those lines.
A couple of years back, Milton Glaser, graphic designer, gave a commencement address, and he's now in his 80s, so if you read the address, most of it is just an 80-year-old rambling. But there's this one passage which he became very present, where he talks about how he realized that, it took him a long time to realize, that there are two types of relationships you have, whether they're relationships with your employees or relationships with your family, relationships with clients, two types of relationships that you have in your life. One are relationships that energize you, and the other are relationships that exhaust you. And he realized that it was his job to himself to focus on the relationships that energize and eliminate the relationships that exhaust, no matter how politically difficult that was. And I have found that that has been an incredibly important epiphany for me, that once I could make sure that I surrounded myself with people who energize me, even when times get tough and the days are exhausting, I know that tomorrow will be energizing. And it makes a whole world of difference. So do this if it energizes you, but don't do it if it exhausts you.
Wow. And I think that with that, we will end this panel. Thank you for learning a little bit about this. Thank you to our panelists. Really appreciate the time. And go forth and do what's right.
Thank you. 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thank you for listening.